Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the big business behind cybersecurity. And Microsoft does a mea culpa from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 7th of May. Good to have you with us. Among the worst-kept secrets in the global economy is the fact that we're all spying on each other. Sometimes it's good old corporate espionage. What's the next trick up Ford's sleeve? Or what might Apple hit us with in a month or two? But sometimes it's a bit more ominous. The Pentagon's latest report to Congress on the threat posed by the Chinese military is Exhibit A today. For the first time, the Obama administration says the Chinese government is out to get us, cyber-wise, on both national security and corporate networks. Kim Zetter is a senior writer at Wired magazine. Kim, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you too, Kai.
This is, it seems to me, official confirmation of this thing that we have all known for a good long while now, right? That the Chinese are cyber spying on us. Does it come at a convenient time for us as we try to think about cyber warfare in this country?
There is a timing that's important to note here. Congress is trying to push through cybersecurity legislation, and lobbyists are trying to push it through as well. And there is a very, protracted fight that's been going on for the last couple of years, and it's gotten a bit angrier this year.
So what's happening in the background then? Are big cybersecurity firms buying up little tiny cybersecurity firms, and just are they going to turn into big sort of behemoths like we have come to know and love in defense contracting?
Well, actually, what's happening is defense contractors are buying up cybersecurity firms. And so what they are seeing is, there's a lot of money to be made in government contracts for cybersecurity. And defense contractors haven't traditionally been in this field. And so rather than trying to build up the capability from scratch, they are, purchasing whole hogs cybersecurity firms to get those contracts.
I imagine it's a two-way street, right? I mean, these defense contractors and cybersecurity firms conduct offensive operations, if you will. They are engaged by the government in figuring out how we can do these things. But also, I imagine they are targeted by the Chinese.
Yes. Their networks are often the weaker choke point for foreign adversaries. If the federal government has classified information, it's oftentimes kept on systems that aren't connected to the internet. Whereas when you've got a defense contractor, you've got a little more, fudging in the networks. They're not quite air-gapped in the same ways. And you have a lot of employees that you can target in order to get into systems.
You guys pointed out in Wired not too long ago that there's this commercial web in cybersecurity and military affairs and all this stuff. I mean, we now, the Pentagon, I guess, contracts with a Chinese satellite company to provide satellite coverage for American soldiers in Africa. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on.
Yeah, this was a pretty wild story because, on the one hand, we are pointing the finger at China and beating the drum saying that they are trying to steal our data. And on the other hand, the Defense Department is turning around and contracting with a satellite firm that is overseen by China in order to transmit military communication. So you've got, a double problem here is one, you're complaining that they're coming after our data. On the other hand, you're handing them the data. So it's hard to complain afterwards that they steal it.
Yeah, make up your minds, right?
There's another sort of possibility here, and that is that this may be sort of a counterintelligence operation. We contract with the Chinese to send our data, and it's really disinformation that we're sending over those tubes, and we're hoping that they decrypt it.
Oh, man, that's too hard. Come on.
Yeah, right? Is your head hurt on that?
Yeah, a little bit. Kim Zetter, she's a senior writer at Wired magazine. She covers cybersecurity for him. Kim, thanks a bunch.
You're welcome.
Don't look now, gang, but yes, that was Dow 15,000 we went blowing by today, or at least sauntered past cavalierly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You don't need me to tell you that healthcare spending in this country knows just one direction. Here, though, is some good news. It's not going up as fast as it used to. A new study in the journal Health Affairs shows that between 2009 and 2011, healthcare spending grew at its slowest rate in 50 years. It could be the start of a beautiful trend that would shave nearly $1 trillion off the national debt in less than a decade if, and you knew this was coming, if it lasts. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
Cautiously optimistic. That's how some of the top people in healthcare put it when they look at this spending data. In the years before the recession, total healthcare spending grew every year between 6 and 9%. The last 4 years, it's been more like 4%.
Now, we don't really know with great precision what's responsible for that.
Drew Altman is president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Health policy folks all agree the recession is part of the answer. Lose your job and you're less likely to see the doctor. But several reports in the last few weeks say there's more to it. Harvard Medical School professor Michael Chernu, who co-authored a study in health affairs, says the culture is shifting.
There are physicians and administrators around the country asking themselves, how are we spending our money and how can we spend less of it and still provide high-quality care?
New health insurance contracts and federal incentives are encouraging doctors and hospitals to think twice before ordering that second MRI or an extra night in the hospital. Chernu believes payment reforms are doing what they're supposed to, squeezing out additional costs. Harvard economist David Cutler, who authored a separate health affairs report, says there's another reason costs are dropping. People with insurance can't afford to see the doctor as much.
Typical individual with a policy from a small employer has a deductible of over $1,000. And for a family, it's probably $2,000 or $3,000. To put this in perspective, that's more money than most people have in the bank.
One of the reasons Cutler thinks the trend of slowing healthcare spending may be sustainable is because you and me have more skin in the game. The higher the deductible, the more the copay, the less we spend. And Cutler says that's a mixed bag. Maybe there are fewer wasteful tests, but it can also mean less preventive care. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico was 3 years ago now. And in that time, BP has spent more than $14 billion down there cleaning up. The company just announced it's going to spend another $500 million or so, going specifically to the five states that border the Gulf. Not everybody, though, is happy with how that money is going to be spent, as Gigi Dubin reports.
BP designated $1 billion in early restoration money from Florida to Texas, including dune and marsh restoration and bringing back bird and sea turtle habitats. The company has cleaned up thousands of miles of shoreline. But some say the latest projects taking a share of BP money have nothing at all to do with the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Take Alabama, for example, where most of the $100 million the state is getting from BP is going toward enhancements, including a new lodge and conference center at Gulf State Park.
Gulf State Park is an integral part of the coastal experience here in Alabama.
That's Herb Malone, president and CEO of Gulf Shores and Orange Beach Tourism in Alabama. He says the old lodge had aged over decades and suffered damage from Hurricane Ivan. But Malone says there is a connection to the spill.
If the oil spill took away the right of human use for the citizens of Alabama for such an extended period of time, then this facility will enhance the human use capabilities, and therefore that's where the mitigation factor comes from.
That, I think, just goes kind of in the face of what these restoration dollars are supposed to be accomplishing.
That's Aaron Viles, deputy director of the environmental group Gulf Restoration Network. He says BP and state officials have misplaced priorities. There's still lots of environmental work to be done, he says.
I think they're choosing economic activity because that's a bigger payout for them politically.
Speaking of economic activity, Herb Malone says Alabama is seeing a record year for tourism along the coast. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
Microsoft is doing a little bit of a walk back today. They're going to be coming out with a fix for Windows 8 here in a little while because there have been some complaints, shall we say, about the new operating system, by which I mean a lot of people hated it. This is just the latest in a long string of missteps in corporate America. Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, it's good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure.
Interesting, don't you think, to see Microsoft backpedaling on this thing?
Yes, long Jobian sigh.
They made a whole big deal in interviews that they've had with people, both Balmer and the woman who runs Windows. They've said, you know, on the touchscreen, Windows 8 is great. And if you got a touchscreen, then you really like it. But we just couldn't get retailers to provide us with touchscreen machines.
Right. So, you know, think about other big, bad decisions that have airbagged up into our consciousness and into our consumer lives. The Firestone Explorer debacle, right, now more than 10 years ago. Apple's antenna gate, to choose one closer in time space, right? Or Starbucks, right? In the early days, Howard Schultz said, okay, all our baristas are going to wear white ties, white shirts, have ties over those steaming, you know, espresso milk machines, and we're going to have lots of opera music playing like a real Italian coffee bar.
You have to say, or we have to say, that Windows 8 is selling not too bad for Microsoft. There's 100 million licenses out there. It's doing just about as well as Windows 7 did, and yet it's reacting to this customer dissatisfaction by going on this PR offensive.
Well, you know, and then you think, so what does this mean for the next, right, auto restock? Because Windows, at least for a lot of businesses, is like, you know, it's like buying your pods for your Verismo machine, right? Like you just sign up at Starbucks.com and they deliver it. It's, you know, it's razor blades. And so then you wonder, right, if their very response to this in the wake of a very successful, you know, kind of sales number, license number, is actually going to cause – you know, CIOs, chief information officers, and all those purchasing folks in corporations to say, oh, wait a minute on Windows 9 or Windows 8.5 or Windows new and improved. So you know, they may be kicking themselves, you know, in the foot here. And there is some example that that's what happens, right, when companies take the road more traveled by and weasel out.
So at the end of the day, Microsoft obviously is a going concern and this is going to be a blip. But is it a cautionary tale, do you think, about hubris and all of that in corporate America?
It is a cautionary tale. We're seeing a consumer zeitgeist that is, you know, can be very, very loyal, but also very fickle and very quick to turn on not just a product, but on their sense of the warp and woof and soul. And, you know, and integrity of the company behind it. So you bet it's a cautionary tale.
I would just venture that nobody ever accused Microsoft of having a soul, right? It's been sort of the company you love to hate for years now.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But all the more reason why, you know, if they cut Steve Jobs and Apple enough slack on antenna gate, Microsoft simply has less rein to run in.
Right. Nancy Kane, she's a historian at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
A real pleasure.
Coming up.
We have got used to the idea that we reward ourselves every time you eat a cupcake or every time you drink alcohol.
First one is always free, but first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, stocks took the high road. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 0.5%, 87 points to close. Yes, close above 15,000 for the first time ever, 15,056. If you want the precise number. The NASDAQ gained 0.1%. That's about 3 points. Finished at 3,396. The S&P 500 added 0.5%, 8 points. Ended at 25. Yeah, it's another record close there. Financial firms helped drive the Dow across the new finish line. J.P. Morgan Chase charged up 2%. Citigroup advanced 1.3% today. Goldman Sachs stepped up about 0.5%. Transportation stocks delivered big gains today. FedEx shares traveled 3.4% higher. UPS packed up a gain of nearly 2%. Ryder, the truck people, also took home 2% more. A lot of big tech names, though, didn't show up for the party. Microsoft found itself behind the 8-ball. Get it? 8-ball, thanks to glitches with Windows 8. The company's shares dropped 1.3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.78%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee holds a hearing on U.S. immigration policies and economic growth. Burger purveyor Wendy's reports quarterly earnings. Want a Coke with that? The next time you walk by the vending machine, think of this. Coca-Cola is 127 years old. Pharmacist John Pemberton invented the syrup for the carbonated beverage on May 8, 1886. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Loath though we are to be the bearers of bad news, we're obliged to tell you it's entirely possible that your travel plans for next year might be a little bit more expensive than you'd planned for. As part of his 2014 budget request, President Obama has proposed an increase in federal taxes and fees for airline tickets. What you're already paying in taxes and fees combined amounts to about 20% of your airfare. So with the prospect of that burden growing, we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to compare goods and services and their taxes.
The proposed taxes would help pay for passenger screening and airport security. Plane tickets aren't the only tax-heavy consumer purchase. Richard Morrison is with the Tax Foundation.
Spirits, beer, cigarettes, gasoline, meals taxes, meals in restaurants, and cell phones often have a much higher than usual tax rate on them.
Uncle Sam slaps a 5.8% tax on cell phone bills. If you live in Nebraska, add a 25% state tax to that. The federal government adds $1 to every pack of cigarettes and $13.50 to every gallon of liquor. And still,
airlines as an industry are taxed more than tobacco and alcohol.
Henry Hardefeld is a travel industry analyst at Hudson Crossing. He says airline taxes take a toll on the industry.
Our research shows that half of travelers allow their budgets to dictate where they end up going.
Hardefeld says higher fees would hit leisure destinations like Florida and Las Vegas especially hard.
My concern is that this could cause some people to say, I'll either stay home or not fly.
But economist Clifford Winston with the Brookings Institution doesn't think that will happen.
There'd be modest increases there, but I don't see a huge change in the price.
If you decide to drive instead of fly, keep this in mind. The federal tax on gas is 18 cents a gallon, and you might want to avoid New York, where you'll pay another 50 cents a gallon in taxes, pretty much the same tax rate you'd pay to fly. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
President Obama was down in Dallas a couple of weeks ago for the opening of the George W. Bush Presidential Library and Museum. Mr. Obama still has 3 years yet, but soon he, too, is going to have to decide where he is going to put his presidential papers and museum and foundation. Chicago's a natural choice, being the birthplace of his career in politics, but the president's actual birthplace wants in on the action, too, for the prestige, of course, but also the economic benefits. And Honolulu is mounting an unusually high-profile campaign to get in on it. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
Hawaii may not be able to compete with Chicago's Middle American location, but standing at the proposed beachfront site, I got views not found on Lake Michigan, including Pacific Waves and Diamond Head's iconic peak. The area's name has the vowel richness one expects from Hawaii. It's called Kaka'ako.
It's the kind of last underdeveloped swath of urban coastline in Honolulu.
University of Hawaii Professor Robert Perkinson is leading the effort to land a presidential center. It's a public bid, unusual when most presidential centers are put together outside the spotlight. Organizers have secured a prime piece of land worth $75 million. Perkinson likes to point out the site's also one of Hawaii's best spots for body surfing, a pastime of the president. Having a presidential center could give people a reason to spend more time and money on the island.
8 million people a year come to Hawaii. When it rains, they're often looking for something educational and enlightening to do.
That's part of a bigger hope that a center could spark development the way the Clinton Library did for Little Rock, bringing jobs and more than 300,000 visitors a year. The construction alone would be a major boost. The recently opened George W. Bush Presidential Center cost $250 million.
You guys brought the phone or the cup?
Honolulu economist Paul Brubaker has his doubts. He suggested we meet at Island Snow, the shaved ice shop the president visits each winter. Brubaker would love to see the Presidential Center in Hawaii, but says the economic impact could be overstated.
I think it's important here in Hawaii for people to keep pushing to achieve, you know, the dream, but maybe to temper their expectations.
Even those backing the bid realize Hawaii's location makes it an underdog to Chicago.
I think the thought was that the former presidential library would be in Chicago.
That's Jim Scott, president of Punahou School. Among the elite school's alumni, Barry Obama. A presidential library needs to be easily accessible to scholars and visitors. Advantage Chicago. That's why Honolulu's leaders named their public campaign the Hawaii Presidential Center Initiative.
If you called it a library, there might be only one library. Whereas with a center, that concept is a little bit broader.
Connie Lau is CEO of banking and energy company Hawaiian Electric Industries, the most prominent business leader supporting the presidential center. She can see the proposed site from the commanding heights of her 30th floor office.
You know, in Hawaii, land is so precious that to have a site like this, something very, very special should be done with it.
Even if the library doesn't rise there, the offices of an Obama foundation or educational program could. Jim Scott says Honolulu would be a great place for the president to work.
He could spend his winters in Hawaii, Chicago's in spring and the summer.
Take President Clinton. His library is in Arkansas and foundation in New York, but Arkansas is where he's really from.
President Obama is an unusual case because he really does have roots in Hawaii and in Illinois, and that is rare.
University of Louisville professor Ben Huffbauer studies presidential libraries. He points to Ronald Reagan. He was born in Illinois, but a Reagan library outside California was unthinkable.
There was just no question that that's where his presidential library would be. And for most presidents, that's the case.
But like a lot of Americans today, President Obama can credibly call more than one state home. He hasn't said where he'll put his library or any part of a presidential center. Hawaii's leaders hope at least some of it lands here. In Honolulu, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
When author Damian Thompson talks about addiction, he's speaking in part from experience. He's an alcoholic who got sober a number of years ago. But he argues in his new book, The Fix, it's called, that it's not just addicts who are like him. It could very well be all of us, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, your iPhone, cupcakes, or the really hard stuff. And that sliding scale can add up to big profits when we get hooked. Damien, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
I wonder how much of what you write in this book can be traced to the problem of prosperity. We just have too much.
Yeah, our bodies were not built for the fabulous, enticing, and artery-clogging choices that greet us everywhere we go. In the office where I'm sitting now, I can see people eating snacks that they wouldn't have bothered to go and fix for themselves 20 years ago because the stalls wouldn't have been there.
Have we then just become accustomed to having this stuff within arm's reach, do you think?
It's actually something to do with the chemistry of our brains. We have got used to the idea that we reward ourselves every time you eat a cupcake or every time you drink alcohol or try particular drugs or all sorts of online sensations. You get a dopamine squirt. You get some sort of reward from your brain chemistry. To put it crudely, it's easier than ever before to measure surges in demand or the stickiness, let's say, of a video game, its addictive qualities, and then to make money out of which tricks work.
Is addiction universally bad?
Yeah, it is, because I think the definition of addiction is my definition of addiction anyway, is the point at which a particular habit starts to cause you harm.
Well, but you know, so I'm thinking here of that study of I guess it was Stanford University students you cited who say, yeah. You know, some percentage of them say they're addicted to their iPhones. First of all, isn't that a little silly? And second of all, nobody ever died from being too involved with their iPhone.
I agree. What I am saying, however, is that technology does have the potential to draw us into darker addictions, that a small proportion of those people who are addicted to spending time online will become addicted to apparently innocent activities such as computer games, such as World of Warcraft or whatever, that take up so much of their time that they just don't have a life.
Mm. There is, of course, an industry devoted to helping people get over their addictions. How big is it? What do we know about it?
At the top end of the market, you know, celebrities regularly check themselves into places which charge them $100,000 a month. The addiction treatment industry has revenues of $34 billion this year. That's an increase of 50% since 2005.
What's your fix right now?
My fix right now is Dexter.
Really? The show?
To be honest. Yeah, I watch it every night until the point where I get into bed, and because of the iPad, I watch it until I'm too tired for work the next morning.
Damian Thompson is a columnist at the Daily Telegraph over in the UK. His most recent book is called The Fix. Damian, thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which life once again proves it is not fair. A study from the career search website The Ladders, which points out that the shorter your name is, the more money you might make. And even worse, every extra letter in your name, we're talking first names only here, people, costs you $3,600 from your annual paycheck. That and a whole bunch of other cool stories about numbers and money and what they mean in our lives is on our new blog at marketplace.org. It's called Buy the Numbers. Check it out. It's worthwhile. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow picked up about 0.5%, 87 points, closed above 15,000 for the first time. The NASDAQ gained 0.1%, 3 points. The S&P 500 added 0.5%, 8 points there. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. That's three letters, R-O-D, by the way. I'm Kai Rizdahl, K-A-I, three letters. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.